Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
I am working with my colleagues here in the Senate and also in the House to ensure that we have a veto-proof majority supporting this legislation.
Senators pass another bill to boost education funding after Governor Dunleavy vetoed their last attempt. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, April 28th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, international students at the University of Alaska have their legal status restored.
The legal community rallied pretty quickly, and it was so blatantly illegal that it was easy to win a lawsuit.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. The Alaska Senate passed a bill today that would substantially boost long-term funding for public schools. The bipartisan vote sets up a final House vote that would send the bill to Governor Dunleavy. The bill includes a $700 per student boost to basic school funding and a number of education policy changes. Lawmakers say it's an attempt to find common ground with the Republican minorities. It comes about a week after lawmakers failed to override Dunleavy's veto of a larger funding boost that passed with bare majorities in the House and Senate. The new bill passed the Senate with broad support on a 19-to-1 vote this morning. Senator Lukey Tobin, an Anchorage Democrat, says she's hoping the new bill can withstand a possible veto from Dunleavy.
I am working with my colleagues here in the Senate and also in the House to ensure that we have a veto-proof majority supporting this legislation.
Dunleavy has not said whether he'll sign the new bill. On Friday, he called for changes, and senators incorporated some, but not all, of his priorities. The bill would limit students' cell phone use, make it easier to create new charter schools, and provide school districts incentive funding based on student reading performance. Those are all items Dunleavy has requested. But some of the governor's proposals were left out. Lawmakers would study, but not necessarily implement, a statewide open enrollment system, and correspondents homeschool would not see an additional funding boost on top of the overall increase. Senate Minority Leader Mike Schauer, a Wasilla Republican, says he voted for the bill despite some reservations.
We believe that we have struck the most reasonable compromise we're going to find this year to get something through that's going to work.
He says he's especially uneasy about one element of the bill. When senators included the reading incentives, they made the program contingent on passing a bill that would tax out-of-state companies that do business in Alaska over the internet. That bill has passed the Senate, but has yet to come up in the House. Several minority Republican senators said they would vote to override a possible veto from Dunleavy. As of this afternoon, the governor had yet to comment on the final bill. A final House vote was initially scheduled for Monday, but the House sent the bill back to the Senate after discovering an error in the bill's language. A final vote is now expected on Wednesday. The Trump administration has changed course and is reversing the termination of international student records, which had put thousands of students across the country at risk for deportation. University of Alaska officials confirmed today that the four impacted University of Alaska students now have restored status. Immigration lawyer Margaret Stock represented one of the students. She says the actions of the Trump administration were illegal, and she thinks the administration buckled under the pressure of dozens of lawsuits filed in response.
They were playing some kind of game where they figured people would self-deport or they just wouldn't react fast enough. But the legal community rallied pretty quickly, and it was so blatantly illegal that it was easy to win a lawsuit. So people were just filing lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit and getting temporary restraining orders immediately.
UAA's Jean Kashikoff was among many students who sued the government and argued that it terminated their records without due process in violation of the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Kashikoff is from Kazakhstan and studied aviation and mathematics in Anchorage. He received his termination notice as he was doing his optional practical training, which allows foreign students to work in the country for up to a year if they're working in their field of study. He was employed as a flight instructor in Wasilla. Cindy Woods, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, represented Kashikoff. She says she was notified Kashikoff's record was restored this morning.
He has status again to be here in the United States and to continue with his optional practical training period. so he can get back to flight instructing and continuing to earn the hours that he needs to launch his career as a pilot.
In announcing the reversal Friday, attorneys with the Justice Department said the federal government is working on a framework to legally terminate foreign student visa records. Well, volunteers in Homer are building Kachemak Bay State Park's first organized response procedure. As KBBI's Simon Lopez reports, the first training kicks off this week.
Last summer, a long-distance hiker went missing in Kachemak Bay State Park. Part of the trail had washed out, leaving her stranded without a clear way forward.
She didn't get the memo that the middle part of the trail she was on was non-existent. And that's how come she got lost.
That's Allison O'Hara, who runs a local water taxi and sits on the nonprofit board for Friends of Kachemak Bay State Park. It took search teams 3 days to get organized and find the missing hiker, who was uninjured and had made it to Kachemak Bay Wilderness Lodge.
Things could go south pretty quickly over there, like if the weather had been a lot worse and, you know, the person got hypothermic or if someone had an injury. I think we could have cut that time down probably to 8 hours instead of 3 days.
O'Hara says it revealed that there was no search and rescue plan in place. So last fall, she started working on building a local search and rescue team through her nonprofit, which supports stewardship and trail maintenance in the area. Now, experts working with O'Hara's group will train community volunteers to respond quickly when someone goes missing. The first step in a search is called a hasty search, to cover ground quickly and locate the person before conditions worsen. The initial training will also cover how to coordinate with law enforcement and work safely in the park's rugged backcountry. O'Hara says volunteers don't need prior search and rescue experience, but should be ready to respond on short notice. The group is also working with local water taxi companies to prevent emergencies before they happen. O'Hara says trail reports and basic trip planning can help visitors avoid getting lost in the first place.
We're in a special situation here where most people who aren't familiar with the area are taking water taxis. We can actually educate them, have the problem not be a problem before they even get on board.
O'Hara says more training opportunities will be available in the future. The first of three Zoom sessions covering rescue basics begins Monday, April 28. More information can be found on the Friends of Kachemak Bay State Parks Facebook page. In Homer, I'm Simon Lopez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Kuskokwim Ice Classic tripod in Bethel signals that spring is here.
Even when it disappears, when it vanishes, gets all crushed up, that's in itself a celebration of, you know, the river's opening up. It's summer.
That's ahead. Stay with us. A U.S. Army bomb squad from Anchorage was dispatched to Ketchikan over the weekend to deal with two separate explosives discovered in the same area. KRBD's Jack Darrell has more.
Ketchikan police executed a search warrant on April 23rd at a U-Haul storage facility near the Refuge Cove Marina, a few miles north of town. Ketchikan Police Chief Eric Mattson says it was part of a drug investigation into a 50-year-old local man named Joey Ellis Khan. Mattson says they found methamphetamine and fentanyl pills and powder, a digital scale, some firearms, and...
Also during that search, the detectives came across a pipe bomb that was discovered in the storage units right there owned and run by the U-Haul. That prompted a phone call to the feds, which we typically do to help with any type of explosive material.
Mattson says they closed off the area and waited for federal explosive experts. The following day, though, a survey crew discovered a live grenade along the tide line at a beach near Refuge Cove. Mattson says the crew called it in to the Alaska State Troopers.
But AST coordinated with getting the U.S. Army Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit from Anchorage down to Ketchikan. That just required both agencies, the troopers and KPD, to sit on both of the locations until they could show up and render both places safe.
The U.S. Army Bomb Squad arrived from Anchorage 2 days later. They took the pipe bomb at the storage unit and the grenade from the beach to the local landfill, where they were safely detonated. Mattson says the grenade was found within proximity of the storage unit, But
it's just a coincidence. These two were not related at all.
Trooper spokesman Austin McDaniel confirmed this. He said that, shockingly, they believe these were two separate and unrelated incidents. A twist that Mattson agreed can only be described as pretty convenient for an out-of-town bomb squad.
It was really convenient. Yeah, absolutely. It just by a mere chance, and I'm glad that they were able to come and do that. And, you know, logistically, this wouldn't happen without either the troopers or the U.S. Army.
McDaniel says there's no active investigation into the origins of the grenade. The man accused in connection with the drugs, weapons, and storage unit pipe bomb, Joey Ellis Khan, was taken into custody on the 23rd. He's being held without bail. He's charged with multiple third and fourth degree possession charges for controlled substances and weapons. In Ketchikan, I'm Jack Darrell.
The Western Alaska hub city of Bethel is set to get high-speed internet in the coming weeks thanks to a tribal-private partnership that has unspooled hundreds of miles of fiber-optic cables along the seafloor, riverbeds, and tundra of the region. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the milestone comes at a time when little is certain about the future of rural broadband.
In less than 2 weeks, a partnership between Bethel Native Corporation and telecommunications provider GCI is set to flip the switch on fiber internet in Bethel, bringing speeds and pricing on par with what customers in Anchorage experience.
Getting to Bethel is the big deal. That's bringing the on-ramp to the information superhighway into Bethel.
That's GCI President and Chief Operating Officer Greg Chapados. He says GCI is targeting May 8th to go live with the iHuck network, bringing residential fiber internet at speeds of up to 2.5 gigabits per second. He says the company will simultaneously be launching its first 5G mobile services in Bethel, something separate from iHuck but enabled by the new ultra-fast fiber.
And then Bethel will be the focal point for activity across the YK Delta.
Since 2021, the unique tribal-private partnership behind iHuck has expanded the scope of the network as federal funding has become available. The project has received more than $100 million in grants to build a network stretching hundreds of miles and serving more than a dozen communities along the Kuskokwim River and far up the Bering Sea coast. The project is applying for funds to extend the network to communities on the lower Yukon River as well.
If they are approved and announced, then we are going to get to that point where we will serve, you know, close to 16,000 residents of the YK Delta. It's something that, you know, frankly, you know, 10 years ago I would have thought it would never happen because it's just the amount of investment required is enormous.
Once the network reaches Emonic at the mouth of the Yukon River sometime in 2027, Chapados says GCI intends to connect up to subsea cables stretching from Nome to Prudhoe Bay, operated by communications company Quintillion. This would create a massive fiber-optic ring around Alaska linking to the lower 48 that Chapados says wouldn't be prone to single points of failure.
If you've got a ringed network, that means if you have a break anywhere on the network, you can change the flow of traffic and continue to serve the communities. It's only if a community has a break on both sides of its network, the incoming network and the outgoing network, that they become isolated. That's a very rare event.
In summer 2023, GCI's services were impacted by a subsea cable cut in the Beaufort Sea to the fiber network operated by Quintillion. As an unringed network, the cut left some Arctic communities in the dark for weeks and brought internet speeds to a crawl across Western Alaska. While iHuck has been funded to bring fiber to 13 communities, there is significant uncertainty about the future of the Biden-era grant programs that could further grow iHuck and similar fiber projects underway in rural Alaska. The lion's share of federal broadband grants are doled out by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration under the U.S. Department of Commerce. The Trump administration's new picks to head both agencies have called for an overhaul of the NTIA's largest program, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, or BEAD program. In its current form, it would bring more than $1 billion to fund high-speed internet access in underserved parts of Alaska. Chapados says changes to BEAD could further delay a program that has already hit plenty of snags since it launched in 2021.
It's unclear right now whether or not there'll be efforts to restructure BEAD, maybe loosen up some of the requirements that are in the original program. That's going to probably delay the actual award of grants out of the program, but we don't believe that BEAD's going to be eliminated.
Next up, after Bethel, IHUC plans to switch on high-speed internet for the communities of Oscarville, Napaskiak, Eek, and Platinum by the end of 2025. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
In part to mesh with Trump administration priorities, Golden Valley Electric Association is changing up or eliminating projects funded by two Biden-era federal awards. KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist reports.
The utility's board of directors adopted the modifications in a unanimous vote on Tuesday. Tom DeLong is the board's chairman.
I guess it was fear to lose the awards or to have them modified in some way that was not acceptable to us.
Golden Valley received both of the awards last year. They total more than $300 million in grants and loans. The text approved by the board on Tuesday had a character limit, and DeLong says he's not sure how the short summary of their proposal adjustments will go over, but that it's meant to be part of an ongoing dialogue.
I don't have very much confidence in anything regarding this area and the current administration, but clearly with 500 characters, including spaces, this is just really keeping our name in the hat and moving the process forward.
The board adopted language says Golden Valley still wants to use the money to fund construction of new battery energy storage systems and new transmission lines. But their modifications strike two key items from the original proposals. One was to retire and refinance debt for the less reliable of the two coal power plants in Healy. The other was to install upgrades at an independent solar farm in Nenana to support a power purchase agreement between that company and Golden Valley. DeLong says nixing the solar farm upgrades has less to do with federal priorities and more to do with the company that owned the farm dissolving. As for the Healy plant, the pressure to keep it operating is twofold. The board had previously decided to postpone retiring the underperforming coal plant due to the natural gas crunch in the Cook Inlet, so DeLong says that change isn't entirely attributable to the new administration. But Trump did sign an executive order in April backing the coal industry. And after that order, the Environmental Protection Agency published a list of nearly 70 coal plants exempted from regulations that limit air pollution from certain toxins. Both of Golden Valley's plants in Healy are on the list.
We can't really shut down Unit 2 with no replacement power, kind of between a rock and a hard spot, whether we remove the language to shut down Unit 2 because of a Trump administration order or the reality of the situation.
Beyond the capital projects, the two Biden-era programs called for Golden Valley to develop other methods for creating additional community benefits. And the language the board passed Tuesday says the utility will alter those plans as well to fit with Trump's executive orders. DeLong declined to comment on exactly what those modifications could look like. But, among other things, the draft community benefit plans aimed to expand educational opportunities to help diversify the workforce, and the federal government under Trump has repeatedly targeted diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. In Fairbanks, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
The weekend of Native Youth Olympic Games wrapped up in Anchorage on Saturday. The event had the highest turnout since the pandemic, and participants from all corners of the state connected with one another. The Alaska Desk's Yelona Nyden reports.
Come on, Daisy!
With much fanfare, Daisy Van Blarkum prepares for the final one-foot high kick competition in the Native Youth Olympics on Saturday. She hits 87 inches, which goes above her personal record, and wins her first place. The bleachers are filled with people from all corners of Alaska, but are familiar faces to Van Blarkum. She says making friends with other athletes and coaches is a part of her success.
I compete a lot better when I know everybody and when I'm comfortable around everyone.
The Native Youth Olympics is a three-day event in which high school students participate in a dozen competitions, each representing a different Alaska Native subsistence activity or skill. Joanna Hobson is one of the coaches working to revive the games in the North Slope region. She says this helps reserved students come out of their shell.
As they're starting to learn more of their cultural games, they're starting to learn that courage, they're starting to learn what it means to be who you are, to accept who you are, where you're at, and then to grow from that.
Participating in the Native Youth Olympics is often a family tradition. Kaya Ehlers is a coach for Salamatov on the Kenai Peninsula. She says she trained some of her siblings and is always proud to see them and her other athletes succeed. This year, her younger sister, Abigail Semikin, got first place in the toe kick competition.
It's really a good confidence booster and really good to see all these young women like competing. And sometimes I do see some girls like getting themselves down, but then once I see that, there's already other girls from other teams coming to comfort her and empowering her again.
Anchorage athlete Anastasia Wild took second place in a 2-foot high kick competition. Like other athletes, she says she loves the community aspect of the games.
We're participating together, not apart. And you get to connect with other people and make new friends. And it's not about winning. It's about beating your personal records and improving not for yourself, but like improving for the others around you so you could help them out with their form and technique as well.
The event started more than 50 years ago with a few dozen participants. This year, the Games brought together about 450 athletes, a record number since the COVID-19 pandemic. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
The Kuskokwim Ice Classic tripod is once again up on the river in front of Bethel. It's part of an annual jackpot prize and nonprofit fundraiser that marks the arrival of spring with the breakup of the river. But as KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, it's also an annual community art project that's designed to disappear. And this year, it's inspired by a three-legged dog.
Eric Whitney crouches before a 25-foot-tall wooden statue on the ice of the Kuskokwim River.
Well, since I get to make them, I get to make them however I want. So I make them funner.
Whitney has been building the Ice Classic tripods for about a decade and spares no time in making them funner. Last year, Whitney constructed a giant bunny. The year before, a blooming flower. This spring, the tripod takes the shape of Whitney's three-legged dog, Charlie.
But he is a super happy dog. So he was kind of an inspiration. And, I mean, if your name's Tripod Charlie, you should just have a tripod.
The tripod is a work of art, but it also serves a utilitarian purpose. When the ice breaks and the tripod falls, it'll stop the clock and mark the official breakup time of the Kuskokwim River in Bethel. To be able to fall, though, the tripod first has to rise. It's the way any great statue, take Michelangelo's David or the Statue of Liberty, might have been erected. It has its moments of doubt and head scratching.
It doesn't look, the angle doesn't look right on that.
Which eventually lead to problem solving.
We could just attach it right with the tail.
With interludes of stepping back, cocking your head to the side, and saying,
Oh, you know, it's always a little rough translating the concept to the actual practice and making sure everything fits together well.
That's Joseph Elhart. He has helped Whitney make this year's tripod over the past few days, using scrap wood and lumber to saw, drill, and paint the statue that's about 4 people tall. Today, on the ice, with the help of some community members, the pieces finally come together. And it's all for a good cause, says Ice Classic manager Haley Hansen.
So the Kuskokwim Ice Classic is an event that is used to raise money for nonprofits in our community, where we have a tripod on the ice that's connected to a clock in the shack on shore. And so when the ice goes out and the tripod travels a certain length of yardage down the river, it trips the clock, and whoever's the closest in their guesses wins money.
But nearly as big of a prize, which in years past can be over a $20,000 jackpot, is its community signaling of spring. Here's Elhart again.
Like, the river is such a huge part of Bethel as a community, as a place. And so having this sculpture again, it's like, even when it disappears, when it vanishes, gets all crushed up, that's in itself a celebration of, you know, the river's opening up. It's summer. Barges will be able to come soon. We'll be able to go upriver, downriver on boats and fish and all this stuff.
The people that live along the Kuskokwim are always watching the river. It's a thoroughfare that becomes a road, a boatable waterway, a source of food, depending on the time of year, connecting the otherwise isolated communities of the region. And this time of year, when the ice becomes too thin to drive, it's a slow waiting game for river breakup. Whitney says he's sometimes able to kayak out through the churning to save pieces of the tripod if the conditions are safe enough. But they often aren't. So the Ice Classic statue, Tripod Charlie, it's kind of like decorating an ornate sandcastle close to the shoreline, or sinking days into carving the perfect pumpkin. It can't last forever.
It's gonna fall over, probably get ground up, washed down the river, maybe end up in the ocean, maybe sit on the bank somewhere abandoned, who knows? But I think there's something beautiful to that. Yeah, that's kind of how life is often. You have things that you build, you have things that you do. They last who knows how long. Can't really predict. If you do, you win a lot of money. And then, you know, they're carried up downstream, and what can you really do?
On the ice in Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone in Juneau, Wesley Early and Ilona Niden in Anchorage, Jack Darrell in Ketchikan, Simon Lopez in Homer, Evan Erickson and Samantha Watson in Bethel, and Patrick Gilchrist in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.